blue bandana around his neck. She could not seem to get enough of crying. She looked into his face and cried. She cried, embracing him. She gave him a styrofoam hamper full of sandwiches, chicken, and coffee. And she cried as he set it down amid the gouged-out seat stuffing and slashed upholstery. "She's a good girl," he told me grimly. In the driver's seat he ran his fingers through his ducktail, checking himself in the rearview mirror. Then he coughed a while, giving us one more episode of lashing phlegm. Babette wept anew. We leaned toward the window on the passenger's side, watching him hunch around into his driving posture, setting himself casually between the door and the seat, his left arm hanging out the window. "Don't worry about me," he said. "The little limp means nothing. People my age limp. A limp is a natural thing at a certain age. Forget the cough. It's healthy to cough. You move the stuff around. The stuff can't harm you as long as it doesn't settle in one spot and stay there for years. So the cough's all right. So is the insomnia. The insomnia's all right. What do I gain by sleeping? You reach an age when every minute of sleep is one less minute to do useful things. To cough or limp. Never mind the women. The women are all right. We rent a cassette and have some sex. It pumps blood to the heart. Forget the cigarettes. I like to tell myself I'm getting away with something. Let the Mormons quit smoking. They'll die of something just as bad. The money's no problem. I'm all set income-wise. Zero pensions, zero savings, zero stocks and bonds. So you don't have to worry about that. That's all taken care of. Never mind the teeth. The teeth are all right. The looser they are, the more you can wobble them with your tongue. It gives the tongue something to do. Don't worry about the shakes. Everybody gets the shakes now and then. It's only the left hand anyway. The way to enjoy the shakes is pretend it's somebody else's hand. Never mind the sudden and unexplained weight loss. There's no point eating what you can't see. Don't worry about the eyes. The eyes can't get any worse than they are now. Forget the mind completely. The mind goes before the body. That's the way it's supposed to be. So don't worry about the mind. The mind is all right. Worry about the car. The steering's all awry. The brakes were recalled 3 times. The hood shoots up on pothole terrain. Deadpan. Babette thought this last part was funny. The part about the car. I stood there amazed, watching her walk in little circles of hilarity, weak-kneed, shambling, all her fears and defenses adrift in the sly history of his voice. Chapter 34. The time of spiders arrived. Spiders in high corners of rooms. Cocoons wrapped in spiderwork. Silvery dancing strands that seemed the pure play of light. Light as evanescent news. Ideas born on light. The voice upstairs said, "Now what's this? Joni is trying to snap Ralph's patella with a Bushido stun kick. She makes contact, he crumples, she runs." Denise passed word to Babette that Steffi was routinely examining her chest for lumps. Babette told me. Murray and I extended the range of our contemplative walks. In town one day, he went into small embarrassed raptures over diagonal parking. There was a charm and a native sense to the rows of slanted vehicles. This form of parking was an indispensable part of the American townscape, even when the cars were foreign-made. The arrangement was not only practical, but avoided confrontation. The sexual assault motif of front-to-back parking in teeming city streets. Murray says it is possible to be homesick for a place even when you are there. the two-story world of an ordinary main street. Modest, sensible, commercial in an unhurried way, a pre-war way, with pre-war traces of architectural detail surviving in the upper stories, in copper cornices and leaded windows, in the amphora frieze above the dime store entrance. It made me think of the law of ruins. I told Murray that Albert Speer wanted to build structures that would decay gloriously, impressively, like Roman ruins. No rusty hulks or gnarled steel slums. He knew that Hitler would be in favor of anything that might astonish posterity. He did a drawing of a Reich structure that was to be built of special materials, allowing it to crumble romantically. A drawing of fallen walls, half columns furled in wisteria. "The ruin is built into the creation," I said, "which shows a certain nostalgia behind the power principle, or a tendency to organize the longings of future generations." Murray said, "I don't trust anybody's nostalgia but my own. Nostalgia is a product of dissatisfaction and rage. It's a settling of grievances between the present and the past. The more powerful the nostalgia, the closer you come to violence. War is the form nostalgia takes when men are hard-pressed to say something good about their country." A humid spell of weather. I opened the refrigerator, peered into the freezer compartment. A strange crackling sound came off the plastic food wrap, the snug covering for half-eaten things, the Ziploc sacks of livers and ribs, all gleaming with sleety crystals. A cold, dry sizzle. A sound like some element breaking down, resolving itself into freon vapors. An eerie static, insistent but near subliminal, that made me think of wintering souls, some form of dormant life approaching the threshold of perception. No one was around. I walked across the kitchen, opened the compactor drawer, and looked inside the trash bag. An oozing cube of semi-mangled cans, clothes hangers, animal bones, and other refuse. The bottles were broken, the cartons flat. Product colors were undiminished in brightness and intensity. Fats, juices, and heavy sludges seeped through layers of pressed vegetable matter. I felt like an archaeologist about to sift through a finding of tool fragments and assorted cave trash. It was about 10 days since Denise had compacted the Dylar. That particular round of garbage had almost certainly been taken outside and collected by now. Even if it hadn't, the tablets had surely been demolished by the compactor ram. These facts were helpful in my efforts to believe that I was merely passing time, casually thumbing through the garbage. I unfolded the bag cuffs, released the latch, and lifted out the bag. The full stench hit me with shocking force. Was this ours? Did it belong to us? Had we created it? I took the bag out to the garage and emptied it. The compressed bulk sat there like an ironic modern sculpture, massive, squat, mocking. I jabbed at it with the butt end of a rake and then spread the material over the concrete floor. I picked through it item by item, mass by shapeless mass, wondering why I felt guilty, a violator of privacy, uncovering intimate and perhaps shameful secrets. It was hard not to be distracted by some of the things they'd chosen to submit to the juggernaut appliance. But why did I feel like a household spy? Is garbage so private? Does it glow at the core with personal heat, with signs of one's deepest nature, clues to secret yearnings, humiliating flaws? What habits, fetishes, addictions, inclinations? What solitary acts, behavioral ruts, I found crayon drawings of a figure with full breasts and male genitals. There was a long piece of twine that contained a series of knots and loops. It seemed at first a random construction. Looking more closely, I thought I detected a complex relationship between the size of the loops, the degree of the knots, single or double, and the intervals between knots with loops and freestanding knots. Some kind of occult geometry or symbolic festoon of obsessions. I found a banana skin with a tampon inside. Was this the dark underside of consumer consciousness? I came across a horrible clotted mass of hair, soap, ear swabs, crushed roaches, flip-top rings, sterile pads smeared with pus and bacon fat, strands of frayed dental floss, fragments of ballpoint refills, toothpicks still displaying bits of impaled food. There was a pair of shredded undershorts with lipstick markings, perhaps a memento of the Grayview Motel. But no sign anywhere of a shattered amber vial or the remains of those saucer-shaped tablets. It didn't matter. I would face whatever had to be faced without chemical assistance. Babette had said Dylar was fool's gold. She was right. Winnie Richards was right. Denise was right. They were my friends, and they were right. I decided to take another physical. When the results were in, I went to see Dr. Chakravarti in his little office in the medical building. He sat there reading the printout, a man with a puffy face and shadowy eyes, his long hands set flat on the desk, his head wagging slightly.
"Here you are again, Mr. Gladney. We see you so often these days. How nice it is to find a patient who regards his status seriously."
"What status?"
"His status as a patient. People tend to forget they are patients. Once they leave the doctor's office or the hospital, they simply put it out of their minds. But you are all permanent patients, like it or not. I am the doctor, you the patient. A doctor doesn't cease being doctor at close of day. Neither should patient. People expect a doctor to go about things with the utmost seriousness, skill, and experience. But what about patient? How professional is he?" He did not look up from the printout as he said these things in his meticulous sing-song.
"I don't think I like your potassium very much at all," he went on. "Look here, a bracketed number with computerized stars."
"What does that mean?"
"There's no point your knowing at this stage."
"How was my potassium last time?"
"Quite average, in fact. But perhaps this is a false elevation. We are dealing with whole blood. There is the question of a gel barrier. Do you know what this means?"
"No."
"There isn't time to explain. We have true elevation and false elevations. This is all you have to know."
"Exactly how elevated is my potassium?"
"It has gone through the roof, evidently."
"What might this be a sign of?"
"It could mean nothing. It could mean a very great deal indeed."
"How great?"
"Now we are getting into semantics," he said.
"What I'm trying to get at is, could this potassium be an indication of some condition just beginning to manifest itself, some condition caused perhaps by an ingestion, an exposure, an involuntary spillage intake, some substance in the air or the rain?"
"Have you, in fact, come in contact with such a substance?"
"No," I said.
"Are you sure?"
"Positive." "Why, do the numbers show some sign of possible exposure?"
"If you haven't been exposed, then they couldn't very well show a sign, could they?"
"Then we agree," I said.
"Tell me this, Mr. Gladney, in all honesty, how do you feel?"
"To the best of my knowledge, I feel very well. First rate. I feel better than I have in years, relatively speaking.
What do you mean, relatively speaking?
Given the fact I'm older now.
He looked at me carefully. He seemed to be trying to stare me down. Then he made a note on my record. I might have been a child facing the school principal over a series of unexcused absences.
I said, "How can we tell whether the elevation is true or false?"
"I will send you to Glassboro for further tests. Would you like that? There is a brand new facility called Autumn Harvest Farms. They have gleaming new equipment. You won't be disappointed. Wait and see. It gleams, absolutely."
"All right. But is potassium the only thing we have to watch?"
"The less you know, the better. Go to Glassboro. Tell them to delve thoroughly. No stone unturned. Tell them to send you back to me with sealed results. I will analyze them down to the smallest detail. I will absolutely pick them apart. They have the know-how at Harvest Farms, the most delicate of instruments, I promise you. The best of third-world technicians, the latest procedures."
His bright smile hung there like a peach on a tree.
"Together, as doctor and patient, we can do things that neither of us can do separately. There is not enough emphasis on prevention. An ounce of prevention, goes the saying. Is this a proverb or a maxim, surely Professor can tell us?"
"I'll need time to think about it."
"In any case, prevention is the thing, isn't it? I've just seen the latest issue of American Mortician. Quite a shocking picture. The industry is barely adequate to accommodating the vast numbers of dead."
Babette was right. He spoke English beautifully. I went home and started throwing things away. I threw away fishing lures, dead tennis balls, torn luggage. I ransacked the attic for old furniture, discarded lampshades, warped screens, bent curtain rods. I threw away picture frames, shoe trees, umbrella stands, wall brackets, high chairs and cribs, collapsible TV trays, beanbag chairs, broken turntables. I threw away shelf paper, faded stationery, manuscripts of articles I'd written, galley proofs of the same articles, the journals in which the articles were printed. The more things I threw away, the more I found. The house was a sepia maze of old and tired things. There was an immensity of things, an overburdening weight, a connection, a mortality. I stalked the rooms, flinging things into cardboard boxes. Plastic electric fans, burnt-out toasters, Star Trek needlepoints. It took well over an hour to get everything down to the sidewalk. No one helped me. I didn't want help, or company, or human understanding. I just wanted to get the stuff out of the house. I sat on the front steps alone, waiting for a sense of ease and peace to settle in the air around me. A woman passing on the street said, "A decongestant, an antihistamine, a cough suppressant, a pain reliever." Chapter 35. Babette could not get enough of talk radio. "I hate my face," a woman said. "This is an ongoing problem with me for years. Of all the faces you could have given me, looks-wise, this one has got to be the worst. But how can I not look? Even if you took all my mirrors away, I would still find a way to look. How can I not look on the one hand? But I hate it on the other. In other words, I still look. Because whose face is it, obviously? What do I do, forget it's there, pretend it's someone else's? What I'm trying to do with this call, Mel, is find other people who have a problem accepting their face. Here are some questions to get us started. What did you look like before you were born? What will you look like in the afterlife, regardless of race or color?" Babette wore her sweatsuit almost all the time. It was a plain gray outfit, loose and drooping. She cooked in it, drove the kids to school, wore it to the hardware store and the stationers. I thought about it for a while, decided there was nothing excessively odd in this,
nothing to worry about, no reason to believe she was sinking into apathy and despair.
"How do you feel?" I said. "Tell the truth."
"What is the truth?"
"I'm spending more time with Wilder. Wilder helps me get by."
"I depend on you to be the healthy, outgoing former Babette. I need this as badly as you do, if not more."
"What is need? We all need. Where is the uniqueness in this?"
"Are you feeling basically the same?"
"You mean, am I sick unto death?"
"The fear hasn't gone, Jack."
"We have to stay active."
"Active helps, but Wilder helps more."
"Is it my imagination," I said, "or is he talking less than ever?"
"There's enough talk."
"What is talk? I don't want him to talk. The less he talks, the better."
"Denise worries about you."
"Who?"
"Denise."
"Talk is radio," she said.
Denise would not let her mother go running unless she promised to apply layers of sunscreen gel. The girl would follow her out of the house to dash a final gob of lotion across the back of Babette's neck, then stand on her toes to stroke it evenly in. She tried to cover every exposed spot, the brows, the lids. They had bitter arguments about the need for this. Denise said the sun was a risk to a fair-skinned person. Her mother claimed the whole business was publicity for disease. "Besides, I'm a runner," she said. "A runner, by definition, is less likely to be struck by damaging rays than a standing or walking figure." Denise spun in my direction, arms flung out, her body beseeching me to set the woman straight.
"The worst rays are direct," Babette said. "This means the faster a person is moving, the more likely she is to receive only partial hits, glancing rays, deflections."
Denise let her mouth fall open, bent her body at the knees. In truth, I wasn't sure her mother was wrong.
"It is all a corporate tie-in," Babette said in summary. "The sunscreen, the marketing, the fear, the disease. You can't have one without the other."
I took Heinrich and his snake-handling buddy, Aurist Mercator, out to the commercial strip for dinner. It was 4 in the afternoon, the time of day when Aurist's training schedule called for his main meal. At his request, we went to Vincent's Casa Mario, a blockhouse structure with slit windows that seemed part of some coastal defense system. I'd found myself thinking of Aurist and his snakes and wanted a chance to talk to him further. We sat in a blood-red booth. Aurist gripped the tasseled menu with his chunky hands. His shoulders seemed broader than ever, the serious head partly submerged between them.
"How's the training going?" I said.
"I'm slowing it down a little. I don't want to peak too soon. I know how to take care of my body."
"Heinrich told me you sleep sitting up to prepare for the cage."
"I perfected that. I'm doing different stuff now."
"Like what?"
"Loading up on carbohydrates."
"That's why we came here," Heinrich said.
"I load up a little more each day."
"It's because of the huge energy he'll be burning up in the cage, being alert, tensing himself when a mamba approaches, whatever."
We ordered pasta and water.
"Tell me, Aurist, as you get closer and closer to the time, are you beginning to feel anxious?"
"What anxious? I just want to get in the cage. Sooner the better. This is what Aurist Mercator is all about."
"You're not nervous? You don't think about what might happen?"
"He likes to be positive," Heinrich said. "This is the thing today with athletes. You don't dwell on the negative."
"Tell me this, then. What is the negative? What do you think of when you think of the negative?"
"Here's what I think. I'm nothing without the snakes. That's the only negative. The negative is if it doesn't come off, if the Humane Society doesn't let me in the cage. How can I be the best at what I do if they don't let me do it?"
I liked to watch Aurist eat. He inhaled food according to aerodynamic principles, pressure differences, intake velocities. He went at it silently and purposefully, loading up,
centering himself, appearing to grow more self-important with each clump of starch that slid over his tongue.
"You know you can get bitten. We talked about it last time. Do you think about what happens after the fangs close on your wrist? Do you think about dying? This is what I want to know. Does death scare you? Does it haunt your thoughts?" "Let me put my cards on the table, Aurist. Are you afraid to die? Do you experience fear? Does fear make you tremble or sweat? Do you feel a shadow fall across the room when you think of the cage, the snakes, the fangs?" "What did I read just the other day? There are more people dead today than in the rest of world history put together. What's one extra? I'd just as soon die while I'm trying to put Aurist Mercator's name in the record book." I looked at my son. I said, "Is he trying to tell us there are more people dying in this 24-hour period than in the rest of human history up to now?" "He's saying the dead are greater today than ever before, combined."
"What dead? Define the dead."
"He's saying people now dead."
"What do you mean, now dead? Everybody who's dead is now dead."
"He's saying people in graves, the known dead, those you can count." I was listening intently, trying to grasp what they meant. A second plate of food came for Aurist. "But people sometimes stay in graves for hundreds of years. Is he saying there are more dead people in graves than anywhere else?"
"It depends on what you mean by anywhere else."
"I don't know what I mean. The drowned? The blown to bits?" "There are more dead now than ever before, that's all he's saying." I looked at him a while longer. Then I turned to Aurist. "You are intentionally facing death. You are setting out to do exactly what people spend their lives trying not to do. Die. I want to know why."
"My trainer says breathe, don't think. He says be a snake and you'll know the stillness of a snake."
"He has a trainer now," Heinrich said.
"He's a Sunni Muslim," Aurist said. "Iron City has some Sunnis out near the airport. The Sunnis are mostly Korean, except mine's an Arab, I think."
I said, "Don't you mean the Moonies are mostly Korean?"
"He's a Sunni," Aurist said.
"But it's the Moonies who are mostly Korean, except they're not, of course. It's only the leadership."
They thought about this. I watched Aurist eat. I watched him pitchfork the spaghetti down his gullet. The serious head sat motionless, an entryway for the food that flew off the mechanical fork. What purpose he conveyed, what sense of a fixed course of action pursued absolutely. If each of us is the center of his or her existence, Aurist seemed intent on enlarging the center, making it everything. Is this what athletes do, occupy the self more fully? It's possible we envy them for a prowess that has little to do with sport. In building toward a danger, they escape it in some deeper sense. They dwell in some angelic scan, able to leap free of everyday dying. But was Aurist an athlete? He would do nothing but sit. Sit for 67 days in a glass cage, waiting to be publicly bitten.
"You will not be able to defend yourself," I said. "Not only that, but you will be in a cage with the most slimy, feared, and repulsive creatures on earth. Snakes. People have nightmares about snakes. Crawling, slithering, cold-blooded, egg-laying vertebrates. People go to psychiatrists. Snakes have a special slimy place in our collective unconscious. And you are voluntarily getting into an enclosed space with 30 or 40 of the most venomous snakes in the world."
"What slimy? They're not slimy."
"The famous sliminess is a myth," Heinrich said. "He's getting into a cage with gaboon vipers with 2-inch fangs. Maybe a dozen mambas. The mamba happens to be the fastest-moving land snake in the world. Isn't sliminess a little besides the point?"
"That's my argument, exactly. Fangs. Snake bite. 50,000 people a year die of snake bite. It was on television last night.
Everything was on television last night, Orest said. I admired the reply.
I guess I admired him, too. He was creating an imperial self out of some tabloid aspiration. He would train relentlessly, speak of himself in the third person, load up on carbohydrates. His trainer was always there, his friends drawn to the aura of inspired risk. He would grow in life strength as he neared the time.
His trainer is teaching him how to breathe in the old way, the sunny Muslim way. A snake is one thing. A person can be a thousand things.
Be a snake, Orest said.
People are getting interested, Heinrich said. It's like it's starting to build. Like he's really going to do it. Like they believe him now. The total package.
If the self is death, how can it also be stronger than death? I called for the check. Extraneous flashes of Mr. Gray. A drizzling image in gray shorts and socks. I lifted several bills from my wallet, rubbing hard with my fingers to make sure there weren't others stuck to them. In the motel mirror was my full-length wife, white-bodied, full-bosomed, pink-kneed, stub-toed, wearing only peppermint leg-warmers, like a sophomore leading cheers at an orgy. When we got home, I found her ironing in the bedroom.
"What are you doing?" I said.
"Listening to the radio, except it just went off.
If you thought we were finished with Mr. Gray, it's time to bring you up to date."
"Are we talking about Mr. Gray the composite or Mr. Gray the individual? It makes all the difference."
"It certainly does."
Denise compacted the pills.
"Does that mean we're all through with the composite?"
"I don't know what it means."
"Does it mean you've turned your male attention to the individual in the motel?"
"I didn't say that."
"You don't have to say it. You're a male.
A male follows the path of homicidal rage. It is the biological path, the path of plain, dumb, blind male biology."
"How smug. Ironing handkerchiefs."
"Jack, when you die, I will just fall to the floor and stay there. Eventually, maybe, after a very long time, they will find me crouching in the dark, a woman without speech or gesture. But in the meantime, I will not help you find this man or his medication."
The eternal wisdom of those who iron and sew.
"Ask yourself what it is you want more, to ease your ancient fear, or to revenge your childish, dopey, injured male pride."
I went down the hall to help Steffi finish packing. A sports announcer said,
"They're not booing, they're saying, 'Bruce, Bruce!'"
Denise and Wilder were in there with her. I gathered from the veiled atmosphere that Denise had been giving confidential advice on visits to distant parents. Steffi's flight would originate in Boston and make two stops between Iron City and Mexico City, but she wouldn't have to change planes, so the situation seemed manageable.
"How do I know I'll recognize my mother?"
"You saw her last year," I said. "You liked her."
"What if she refuses to send me back?"
"We have Denise to thank for that idea, don't we? Thank you, Denise."
"Don't worry, she'll send you back."
"What if she doesn't?" Denise said. "It happens, you know."
"It won't happen this time."
"You'll have to kidnap her back."
"That won't be necessary."
"What if it is?" Steffi said.
"Would you do it?" Denise said.
"It won't happen in a million years."
"It happens all the time," she said. "One parent takes the child, the other parent hires kidnappers to get her back."
"What if she keeps me?" Steffi said. "What will you do?"
"He'll have to send people to Mexico. That's the only thing he can do."
"But will he do it?" she said.
"Your mother knows she can't keep you," I said. "She travels all the time. It's out of the question."
"Don't worry," Denise told her. "No matter what he says now, he'll get you back when the time comes."
Steffi looked at me with deep interest and curiosity. I told her I would travel to Mexico myself and do whatever had to be done to get her back here. She looked at Denise.
"It's better to hire people," the older girl said helpfully. "That way you have someone who's done it before."
Babette came in and picked up Wilder.
"There you are," she said. "We're going to the airport with Steffi."
"Yes, we are. Yes, yes."
"Bruce! Bruce!"
The next day there was an evacuation for noxious odor. Simuvac vehicles were everywhere. Men in Milex suits patrolled the streets, many of them carrying instruments to measure harm. The consulting firm that conceived the evacuation gathered a small group of computer-screened volunteers in a police van in the supermarket parking lot. There was half an hour of self-induced gagging and vomiting. The episode was recorded on videotape and sent somewhere for analysis. 3 days later, an actual noxious odor drifted across the river. A pause, a careful thoughtfulness, seemed to settle on the town. Traffic moved more slowly. Drivers were exceedingly polite. There was no sign of official action, no jitneys or ambulettes painted in primary colors. People avoided looking at each other directly. An irritating sting in the nostrils, a taste of copper on the tongue. As time passed, the will to do nothing seemed to deepen, to fix itself firmly. There were those who denied they smelled anything at all. It is always that way with odors. There were those who professed not to see the irony of their inaction. They'd taken part in the Simuvac exercise but were reluctant to flee now. There were those who wondered what caused the odor, those who looked worried, those who said the absence of technical personnel meant there was nothing to worry about. Our eyes began to water. About 3 hours after we'd first become aware of it, the vapor suddenly lifted, saving us from our formal deliberations. Chapter 36. Now and then I thought of the Zumwalt automatic hidden in the bedroom. The time of dangling insects arrived. White houses with caterpillars dangling from the eaves. White stones in driveways. You can walk at night down the middle of the street and hear women talking on the telephone. Warmer weather produces voices in the dark. They are talking about their adolescent sons. How big, how fast. The sons are almost frightening. The quantities they eat, the way they loom in doorways. These are the days that are full of wormy bugs. They are in the grass, stuck to the siding, hanging in the air. Hanging from the trees and eaves, stuck to the window screens. The women talk long distance to the grandparents of the growing boys. They share the trimline phone, beamish old folks in hand-knit sweaters on fixed incomes. What happens to them when the commercial ends? I got a call myself one night. The operator said, "There's a Mother Davy that wishes to talk collect to a Jack Gladney. Do you accept?" "Hello, Janet. What do you want?"
"Just to say hello. To ask how you are. We haven't talked in ages."
"Talked?"
"Swami wants to know if our son is coming to the ashram this summer."
"Our son?"
"Yours, mine, and his. Swami regards the children of his followers as his children."
"I sent a daughter to Mexico last week. When she gets back, I'll be ready to talk about the son."
"Swami says Montana will be good for the boy. He will grow out, fill out. These are his touchy years."
"Why are you calling? Seriously?"
"Just to greet you, Jack. We greet each other here."
"Is he one of those whimsical swamis with a snow-white beard, sort of fun to look at?"
"We're serious people here. The cycle of history has but 4 ages. We happen to be in the last of these. There is little time for whimsy."
Her tiny, piping voice bounced down to me from a hollow ball in geosynchronous orbit. "If Heinrich wants to visit you this summer, it's all right with me. Let him ride horses, fish for trout. But I don't want him getting involved in something personal and intense, like religion.
There's already been some kidnap talk around here. People are edgy.
The last age is the age of darkness.
Fine, now tell me what you want.
Nothing. I have everything. Peace of mind, purpose, true fellowship. I only wish to greet you. I greet you, Jack. I miss you. I miss your voice. I only wish to talk a while, pass a moment or two in friendly reminiscence.
I hung up and went for a walk. The women were in their lighted homes talking on the phone. Did Swami have twinkling eyes? Would he be able to answer the boys' questions where I had failed, provide assurances where I had incited bickering and debate? How final is the age of darkness? Does it mean supreme destruction? A night that swallows existence so completely that I am cured of my own lonely dying? I listened to the women talk. All sound, all souls. When I got home, I found Babette in her sweatsuit by the bedroom window, staring into the night. Delegates to the Hitler conference began arriving. About 90 Hitler scholars would spend the 3 days of the conference attending lectures, appearing on panels, going to movies. They would wander the campus with their names lettered in Gothic type on laminated tags pinned to their lapels. They would exchange Hitler gossip, spread the usual sensational rumors about the last days in the Führer bunker. It was interesting to see how closely they resembled each other, despite the wide diversity of national and regional backgrounds. They were cheerful and eager, given to spitting when they laughed, given to outdated dress, homeliness, punctuality. They seemed to have a taste for sweets. I welcomed them in the starkly modern chapel. I spoke in German, from notes, for 5 minutes. I talked mainly about Hitler's mother, brother, and dog. His dog's name was Wolf. This word is the same in English and German. Most of the words I used in my address were the same or nearly the same in both languages. I'd spent days with the dictionary compiling lists of such words. My remarks were necessarily disjointed and odd. I made many references to Wolf, many more to the mother and the brother, a few to shoes and socks, a few to jazz, beer, and baseball. Of course, there was Hitler himself. I spoke the name often, hoping it would overpower my insecure sentence structure. The rest of the time I tried to avoid the Germans in the group, even in my black gown and dark glasses, with my name in Nazi typeface over my heart. I felt feeble in their presence, death-prone, listening to them produce their guttural sounds, their words, their heavy metal. They told Hitler jokes and played pinochle. All I could do was mutter a random monosyllable, rock with empty laughter. I spent a lot of time in my office, hiding. Whenever I remembered the gun, lurking in a stack of undershirts like a tropical insect, I felt a small, intense sensation pass through me. Whether pleasurable or fearful, I wasn't sure. I knew it mainly as a childhood moment, the profound stir of secret-keeping. What a sly device a handgun is, one so small in particular. An intimate and cunning thing, a secret history of the man who owns it. I recalled how I'd felt some days earlier trying to find the Dalar, like someone spying on the family garbage. Was I immersing myself little by little in a secret life? Did I think it was my last defense against the ruin worked out for me so casually by the force or non-force, the principle or power or chaos that determines such things? Perhaps I was beginning to understand my ex-wives and their ties to intelligence. The Hitler scholars assembled, wandered, ate voraciously, laughed through oversized teeth. I sat at my desk in the dark, thinking of secrets. Are secrets a tunnel to a dream world where you control events?
In the evening, I sped out to the airport to meet my daughter's plane. She was excited and happy, wore Mexican things. She said the people who sent her mother books to review wouldn't leave her alone. Dana was getting big, thick novels every day, writing reviews, which she microfilmed and sent to a secret archive. She complained of jangled nerves, periods of deep spiritual fatigue. She told Steffi she was thinking of coming in from the cold. In the morning, I sped out to Glassboro to take the further tests my doctor had advised at Autumn Harvest Farms. The seriousness of such an occasion is directly proportionate to the number of bodily emissions you are asked to cull for analysis. I carried with me several specimen bottles, each containing some melancholy waste or secretion. Alone in the glove compartment rode an ominous plastic locket, which I'd reverently enclosed in three interlocking baggies, successively twist-tied. Here was a daub of the most solemn waste of all, certain to be looked upon by the technicians on duty with the mingled deference, awe, and dread we have come to associate with exotic religions of the world. But first I had to find the place. It turned out to be a functional pale brick building, one story, with slab floors and bright lighting. Why would such a place be called Autumn Harvest Farms? Was this an attempt to balance the heartlessness of their gleaming precision equipment? Would a quaint name fool us into thinking we live in precancerous times? What kind of condition might we expect to have diagnosed in a facility called Autumn Harvest Farms? Whooping cough? Croup? A touch of the grip? Familiar old farmhouse miseries calling for bed rest. A deep chest massage with soothing Vicks vapor rub. Would someone read to us from David Copperfield? I had misgivings. They took my samples away, sat me down at a computer console. In response to questions on the screen, I tapped out the story of my life and death, little by little, each response eliciting further questions in an unforgiving progression of sets and subsets. I lied three times. They gave me a loose-fitting garment and a wristband ID. They sent me down narrow corridors for measuring and weighing, for blood testing, brain graphing, the recording of currents traversing my heart. They scanned and probed in room after room, each cubicle appearing slightly smaller than the one before it, more harshly lighted, emptier of human furnishings. Always a new technician. Always faceless fellow patients in the maze-like halls, crossing from room to room, identically gowned. No one said hello. They attached me to a seesaw device, turned me upside down, and let me hang for 60 seconds. A printout emerged from a device nearby. They put me on a treadmill and told me to run, run. Instruments were strapped to my thighs, electrodes planted on my chest. They inserted me in an imaging block, some kind of computerized scanner. Someone sat typing at a console, transmitting a message to the machine that would make my body transparent. I heard magnetic winds, saw flashes of northern light. People crossed the hall like wandering souls, holding their urine aloft in pale beakers. I stood in a room the size of a closet. They told me to hold one finger in front of my face, close my left eye. The panel slid shut. A white light flashed. They were trying to help me, to save me. Eventually, dressed again, I sat across a desk from a nervous young man in a white smock. He studied my file, mumbling something about being new at this. I was surprised to find that this fact did not upset me. I think I was even relieved. How long before the results are in? The results are in, he said. I thought we were here for a general discussion. The human part. What the machines can't detect. In 2 or 3 days, the actual numbers would be ready. The numbers are ready. I'm not sure I'm ready. All those gleaming devices are a little unsettling. I could easily imagine a perfectly healthy person being made ill just taking these tests.
Why should anyone be made ill? These are the most accurate test devices anywhere. We have sophisticated computers to analyze the data. This equipment saves lives.
Believe me, I've seen it happen. We have equipment that works better than the latest X-ray machine or CAT scanner. We can see more deeply, more accurately.
He seemed to be gaining confidence. He was a mild-eyed fellow with a poor complexion and reminded me of the boys at the supermarket who stand at the end of the checkout counter bagging merchandise.
"Here's how we usually start," he said. "I ask questions based on the printout, and then you answer to the best of your ability. When we're all finished, I give you the printout in a sealed envelope, and you take it to your doctor for a paid visit."
"Good."
"Good. We usually start by asking, how do you feel?"
"Based on the printout?"
"Just, how do you feel?" he said in a mild voice.
"In my own mind, in real terms, I feel relatively sound, pending confirmation."
"We usually go on to tired. Have you recently been feeling tired?"
"What do people usually say?"
"Mild fatigue is a popular answer."
"I could say exactly that and be convinced in my own mind it's a fair and accurate description."
He seemed satisfied with the reply and made a bold notation on the page in front of him.
"What about appetite?" he said. "I could go either way on that."
"That's more or less how I could go, based on the printout."
"In other words, you're saying sometimes I have appetitive reinforcement, sometimes I don't."
"Are you telling me or asking me?"
"It depends on what the numbers say."
"Then we agree."
"Good."
"Good," he said. "Now what about sleep? We usually do sleep before we ask the person if they'd like some decaf or tea. We don't provide sugar."
"Do you get a lot of people who have trouble sleeping?"
"Only in the last stages."
"The last stages of sleep? Do you mean they wake up early in the morning and can't get back to sleep?"
"The last stages of life."
"Well, that's what I thought."
"Good.
The only thing I have is some low-threshold animation."
"Good."
"I get a little restless."
"Who doesn't?"
"Toss and turn?"
"Toss," I said.
"Good."
"Good."
He made some notes. It seemed to be going well. I was heartened to see how well it was going. I turned down his offer of tea, which seemed to please him. We were moving right along.
"Here's where we ask about smoking."
"That's easy. The answer is no. And it's not a matter of having stopped 5 or 10 years ago. I've never smoked, even when I was a teenager. Never tried it. Never saw the need."
"That's always a plus."
I felt tremendously reassured and grateful. "We're moving right along, aren't we?"
"Some people like to drag it out," he said. "They get interested in their own condition. It becomes almost like a hobby."
"Who needs nicotine? Not only that, I rarely drink coffee, and certainly never with caffeine. Can't understand what people see in all this artificial stimulation. I get high just walking in the woods."
"No caffeine always helps."
"Yes," I thought. "Reward my virtue. Give me life."
"Then there's milk," I said. "People aren't happy with the caffeine and the sugar. They want the milk, too. All those fatty acids. Haven't touched milk since I was a kid. Haven't touched heavy cream. Eat bland foods. Rarely touch hard liquor. Never knew what the fuss was all about. Water, that's my beverage. A man can trust a glass of water." I waited for him to tell me I was adding years to my life.
"Speaking of water," he said, "have you ever been exposed to industrial contaminants?"
"What?"
"Toxic material in the air or water."
"Is this what you usually ask after the cigarettes?"
It's not a scheduled question.
You mean, do I work with a substance like asbestos? Absolutely not. I'm a teacher. Teaching is my life. I've spent my life on a college campus. Where does asbestos fit into this?
Have you ever heard of niodine derivative?
Should I have, based on the printout?
There are traces in your bloodstream.
How can that be if I've never heard of it?
The magnetic scanner says it's there.
I'm looking at bracketed numbers with little stars. Are you saying the printout shows the first ambiguous signs of a barely perceptible condition deriving from minimal acceptable spillage exposure?
Why was I speaking in this stilted fashion? The magnetic scanner is pretty clear, he said.
What had happened to our tacit agreement to advance smartly through the program without time-consuming and controversial delving? What happens when someone has traces of this material in his or her blood?
They get a nebulous mass, he said.
But I thought no one knew for sure what niodine D did to humans. Rats, yes.
You just told me you'd never heard of it.
How do you know what it does or doesn't do? He had me there. I felt I'd been tricked, carried along, taken for a fool. Knowledge changes every day, he said. We have some conflicting data that says exposure to this substance can definitely lead to a mass. His confidence was soaring. Good. Let's get on to the next topic. I'm in something of a hurry.
This is where I hand over the sealed envelope.
Is exercise next? The answer is none. Hate it. Refuse to do it.
Good. I'm handing over the envelope.
What is a nebulous mass, just out of idle curiosity?
A possible growth in the body.
And it's called nebulous because you can't get a clear picture of it.
We get very clear pictures.
The imaging block takes the clearest pictures humanly possible. It's called a nebulous mass because it has no definite shape, form, or limits. What can it do in terms of worst-case scenario contingencies?
Cause a person to die.
Speak English, for God's sake. I despise this modern jargon. He took insults well. The angrier I got, the better he liked it. He radiated energy and health.
Now is where I tell you to pay in the outer office.
What about potassium? I came here in the first place because my potassium was way above normal limits.
We don't do potassium.
Good.
Good.
The last thing I'm supposed to tell you is take the envelope to your doctor. Your doctor knows the symbols. So that's it then. Good.
Good,
he said. I found myself shaking his hand warmly. Minutes later, I was out on the street. A boy walked splay-footed across a public lawn, nudging a soccer ball before him. A second kid sat on the grass, taking off his socks by grabbing the heels and yanking. How literary, I thought peevishly. Streets thick with the details of impulsive life as the hero ponders the latest phase in his dying. It was a partially cloudy day with winds diminishing toward sunset. That night I walked the streets of Blacksmith. The glow of blue-eyed TVs. The voices on the touch-tone phones. Far away, the grandparents huddle in a chair, eagerly sharing the receiver as carrier waves modulate into audible signals. It is the voice of their grandson, the growing boy whose face appears in the snapshots set around the phone. Joy rushes to their eyes, but it is misted over, infused with a sad and complex knowing. What is the youngster saying to them? His wretched complexion makes him unhappy. He wants to leave school and work full-time at Foodland, bagging groceries. He tells them he likes to bag groceries. It is the one thing in life he finds satisfying. Put the gallon jugs in first, square off the six-packs, double-bag the heavy merch. He does it well. He has the knack. He sees the items arranged in the bag before he touches a thing.
It's like Zen, Grandpa. I snap out two bags, fit one inside the other. Don't bruise the fruit,